Kia ora and welcome back to the Amerinds Podcast. This is episode 271, and today is Tuesday, December 20, 2011. Well, I've been away for a variety of reasons, none the least of which is that I was busy. And I don't mean busy in a good way. I mean busy in a very, very bad way. And I'll talk about that later at the very end of the podcast. I also have a few updates here and there. But the main topic today is going to be about the election, to sort of wrap that up, put a little bow on it. But first, I wanted to say that I had mentioned before that I was going to do a revisiting of my episode on moving to New Zealand, and I am still going to do that, but I've decided to delay it until the first full week in January. And the reason I'm doing that is because Nigel goes on holiday around midday on Friday this week, and he will be off for the next 2 weeks, the week following Christmas and the week following New Year's. And he'll be going back to work, I guess it must be on Monday the 9th. So that's when I'm going to be doing that episode. And the reason is because since Nigel's going to be home, I'm not going to be taking time to record. I'm going to be spending time with him, and also we've got relatives coming up for Christmas. And that's what I'm going to be doing. I'm not going to be recording. So I'm probably going to be taking those 2 weeks off as well. Of course, you will remember that because Christmas and Boxing Day, the 25th and 26th, are both public holidays, if they fall on the weekend, they're shifted to the next weekday. So Christmas, of course, is on Sunday. Boxing Day, the 26th, is on a Monday. So that the 26th becomes Christmas Day observed, and Tuesday becomes Boxing Day observed. And so we have a four-day weekend, of course. And what that means is that Nigel's taking off those 2 weeks. Oh, the same thing happens the following week with the first and second, which are both shifted to the following weekdays if they happen to fall on the weekend. And so we have another four-day weekend after that. And what that means is that Nigel will be taking those 2 weeks off, but he's only going to be using, 6 days to do it. So that's a pretty sweet deal. I did that. I have done that a couple of times in the past. So and people do try to do that. Some companies actually still shut down for that period, and they have their employees take their annual leave at that time, either that or take it without pay, whatever they want to do, but they shut down during that time nevertheless. And it is a really quiet time in Auckland, and I may talk a bit more about that afterwards. But the main topic today is the election, and it was a very big deal. I actually started this episode and called it Aftermath on a couple of days afterwards. I think it was the Tuesday after the elections. Would that be the 29th or something like that? And I put together sound clips of both Prime Minister John Key and the leader of the opposition, Labour leader Phil Goff, doing their election night speeches. But so much time has passed, it seems kind of pointless now. So I decided to just skip it. But instead, I'm just going to talk a bit about the election results, and what happened as a result of them. Now, the election, of course, was held on Saturday, November 26th, and then 10 days later... it wasn't actually 10 days later, it was on the 10th, so however long that is, December 10th was when the special votes were announced. Now, special votes come into a few different categories. There are what are called special declaration votes. And special declaration votes are, for instance, you can register up until the day before Election Day. You can't register to vote on Election Day, but you can register up until the Friday before. However, you won't be on the voting lists anywhere, so you have to do a special declaration vote at the polling place. The other kind of special votes are overseas voters, and apparently this year there were about 20,000 of them that were added to the tally. And so those always, well, I was going to say they slow things down a bit, and that's not entirely true, because they are pretty good at getting things counted pretty quickly. Now, on election night, there were some surprises. The electorate of Christchurch Central was a dead heat. They were exactly tied, the Labour and the National Party candidate. And in Waitakere, the Labour MP and the National MP have been back and forth all night long. And then the National MP, Paula Bennett, who's the Minister for Social Welfare or whatever it is, actually she is, and that's why her nickname is Paula Benefit, just so you have a little insider information. She ended up ahead. Well, after the special, the National Party had 60 seats, Labour 34, the Greens had 13, and then I'll talk about the rest later because they didn't change. However, after the special votes were counted, The Labor candidate in Waitakere was ahead by 11 votes. Her name is Carmel Cipollone, and she was ahead by 11 votes. And that was, you know, not exactly a huge margin. So there's what they did, what was called a judicial recount, and Paula Bennett ended up winning by nine votes. Now, there are allegations of some irregularities in Waitakere, and there is talk that there should be, they should petition for I've forgotten what it's called, but it's another kind of recount. But the loser in that has to pay the winner. And the last time that happened was when Winston Peters, the leader of the New Zealand First Party, lost the Tauranga electorate to this crazy guy whose name I've forgotten, Bob somebody or other. Winston Peters ended up having to pay him $20,000 for expenses. So it's not something you do lightly, and you certainly don't do it unless you're absolutely certain that you're going to win. It looks like that's going to be the final result, and that means that Carmel Cipollone is out of Parliament because she wasn't high enough on the Labour Party list to get back in that way. Meanwhile, in Christchurch Central, the National Party candidate, whose name I can't remember off the top of my head, I think it's somebody Wagner, Nikki Wagner is her name, he lost by 45 votes. And I don't think that that he's going to pursue that special recount either because... again, because of the expense of it, and he just delayed the certainty of it. However, because of the special votes, National end up losing one seat, which means that this guy named Aaron Gilmore is out of Parliament, and the Greens picked up one seat. And the 14th seat is Mojo Mathers, who is New Zealand's first profoundly deaf MP, which is kind of interesting in itself. And but she's highly regarded by actually people on both sides of the aisle. And so that actually bodes well. Now, the New Zealand Green Party is the first Green Party anywhere in the world to get more than 10% of the popular vote. They got, I don't have the statistic up in front of me, but they got something like 11 point something odd percent of the popular vote, ultimately. And more or less, the polling that I kept talking about throughout the campaign season, the final vote ended up being pretty close to the polls. I said that there's always some movement in the final results. They don't mirror the general election precisely, and that was certainly the case this time. National was lower than the polls were indicating. Labor was a bit higher, actually quite a bit higher than some of the polls were indicating. The Greens were coming in roughly where they were polling. ACT was a bit lower. The Māori Party was a bit higher. So it's a little bit kind of all over the place. But the one party that did really well and continued to grow right up until Election Day was New Zealand First. And therein lies a story. Apparently, quite a few of the people who voted for New Zealand First were Labour Party voters who did so in the delusion that that was somehow going to help the Labour Party. What they ended up doing, of course, was throwing out some really good, really capable Labour Party MPs in order to get a motley crew of misfits. Because the people that Winston Peters brought in with him are just bizarre. One of them is this guy named Andrew Williams, who was the last mayor of North Shore City before amalgamation. And he was famous for peeing on a lemon tree in the middle of this area of North Shore called Tekapuna. And apparently he also peed on the side of the council buildings, although I haven't been able to confirm that. But that's what he's most notorious for. And another one is a guy whose name is Richard Prosser. I think it's Richard Prosser, anyways, his surname. And he's a nutcase. He called for a separate parliament for the South Island. Actually, I think he's from the North Island, too, which makes it even more bizarre. Called for a separate parliament for the South Island. He was a columnist for this right-wing radical magazine called Investigate, which specializes in conspiracy theories mostly. It says that condoms don't prevent the spread of HIV and naturally being gay is a choice and all these sorts of things. It's a nutty, nutty magazine. It's published by a guy I think I've mentioned before named Ian Wishart, who is just a lunatic. Anyway, and he also has had in the past strong ties with white supremacists. And if I'm not mistaken, they actually endorsed him. I've forgotten which electorate he was technically standing in, and which is not the kind of people you want supporting you, let's be honest. And another of the New Zealand First MPs, I've forgotten her name, but she was a New Zealand First MP in 2005, and she voted against the Civil Unions Bill. Now, the New Zealand First Party is a conservative party, although they have supported Labour-led governments in the past. And so I wouldn't expect anything good. The only thing that there will be out of this is huge entertainment value as we watch Winston Peters demolishing John Key. because he's got the gift of the gab, does Winston. He's an idiot and self-centered and vain and several other things, but he is entertaining. I got to give him that. So after the special votes were counted, National had 59 seats, which is less than a majority. There are 60 there this year. There are going to be 121 seats in Parliament because several parties got more seats than their party vote would have entitled them to. Pardon me. The Māori Party, one of them. So there's an extra seat. And that means that National, when it had 60 seats, still needed somebody to work with them in order to form government. Well, now that they've dropped to 59 seats, they absolutely need other people in order to maintain a majority. So the people that they have done a formal deal with are United Future, which is Peter Dunn in Belmont, Oharu, how you pronounce that, which is down Wellington Way. And also John Banks won the Epsom electorate, and he was the only, however, the party vote was so low, he was the only ACT Party, and I put that in quote marks, MP elected Parliament. He's actually a National Party guy. He just has the ACT label on him. On election night, Don Brash, the failed leader of the National Party who had taken over ACT to save it, and he said he was going to get 15 MPs, ended up resigning, announcing his resignation on election night. You know, good job. Good riddance to bad rubbish. And so now John Banks is technically the only ACT person there is now. I don't think the party is going to come back. I think that it's the end of the ACT party, and there will probably be a new party to take its place. And John Banks will eventually rejoin the National Party, and then he won't run again, I wouldn't think, in 2014, because he's well, I just don't think he will. So that's the situation in for them. So it was National's 59 seats, ACT's 1, and United Future's 1, which now gives them 61 seats, which is a majority. But they also have done a deal with the Māori Party, who have 3 seats. They dropped 1. And technically they only dropped 1, because one of them they lost earlier to Honi Harawira, which I have mentioned, and he retained his seat, so the Mana Party has 1 seat in Parliament. National has quite a few seats to spare, but they are also, just today, John Key was talking about trying to do a formal deal with the Greens, basically to give them a wider margin to operate in, and what they want from the Greens, what they would want, is for them to abstain on confidence and supply, because the Greens won't vote affirmatively on confidence and supply for a National-led government because they're, you know, nearly opposites. But what they want is to have them abstain. And that's theoretically possible. And you will remember, that when I talked about this going into the election, I said that one of the reasons I didn't want to give my party vote to the Greens was because I was afraid that it would lead to supporting a National-led government. Well, it doesn't really matter what the Greens do, if they do this agreement or not, because National has more than enough votes to do whatever it wants with its partners. So in that sense, it doesn't matter. But it still would give me, if I were a Green Party voter, and I'm not, it would give me pause if the party were to agree now to give confidence and to agree to abstain on confidence and supply when National will be doing things that they absolutely, completely oppose. In the end, I did give 2 ticks to Labor, as I said I would. Not that it made any difference. Labor dropped to 34 seats. It was their worst election result since 1996, which is ironic, because one of the reasons why they did so poorly in 1996, they had 2 things. They had a challenge from the left from what used to be called the Alliance, and the Greens at that time were part of the Alliance. And they also had a lot of Labor voters who were voting for New Zealand First under the assumption that New Zealand First would form a coalition with Labor to create government. But in the end, that's not what happened, because Winston Peters used to be a National Party MP, and that he is a conservative, so naturally he went and supported the government of then-Prime Minister Jim Bolger. And much to everybody's shock and dismay, and his party ended up falling apart in within a year or two, I can't remember now. And Jenny Shipley rolled Jim Bolger to become the first female prime minister. And then in 1999, National was turfed out and Labor took power in its own right. And New Zealand First was punished in that election. But Winston Peters held on to Tauranga, so they maintained MPs. So, in 34 seats, Labor has been pretty well decimated. It's not quite what a lot of the media has been reporting. They've been talking about Christchurch Central, for example, and they've always described it as a former Labour stronghold and how this is indicative of how bad the party has become. There's an element of truth to that, which I'll come back to, but there's another element that the media keeps not talking about enough. And that's the fact, you know, there was this event that happened in Christchurch last year called an earthquake, which dramatically changed the dynamics in Christchurch, in Canterbury generally, but the Christchurch Central electorate in this case in particular. And one of the things that happened is a lot of people left. And the people who left were, by and large, young working-age people who could go somewhere else to work. Now, some of them will eventually return, but many of them never will. They could cast special votes to vote back in Christchurch Central, but it's frankly a bit of a hassle to do that, and quite a few people wouldn't have been bothered, especially Labour voters who haven't bothered to vote in the past two elections. So it was a big ask for Labour to hold that electorate. I mean, let's be honest, the people who were left behind were the poor, who couldn't get out, and they, although they very often do lean Labour, they have an abysmal voting record, and the elderly, who are overwhelmingly National Party supporters. So Labour was up against it all along, and although they should have been able to retain it, I'm not surprised that they didn't. And in Waitakere, the situation, again, is that the poor and the working poor tend not to vote. And that was certainly what happened in Waitakere. The Labour vote was just low. And the fact that so many, apparently some 50-odd thousand or something, or maybe it was even more, Labour voters voted for New Zealand First, as I said, under the erroneous assumption that it would somehow help Labour. And so you add that together. You add the depressed vote for Labour, the fact that many Labour voters voted either for New Zealand First because they thought they were doing Labour a favor, or for the Greens because they thought that Labour was going to lose anyway. And what you get is a massacre, essentially. And a lot of good people were lost in that election. A guy named Stuart Nash, who is the grandson, I think, of Walter Nash, a former Prime Minister of New Zealand, and several other people, Kelvin Davis and several other MPs who had a lot of promise, missed out because they put some union hacks ahead of them on the party list. And I'm sorry, that's what they are. I call it as I see it. They are not necessarily good MPs. They just happen to be demanded. Their presence is demanded by unions, and the Labour Party has always been had strong ties with the labor movement. That's how they began. They began in a town called Blackball on the west coast of the South Island. And I don't know if this is true for all unions, but certainly several unions, if you are a member of that union, you're automatically a member of the Labour Party. So what the labor unions want, the labor unions get. And that ended up creating a list that was not a good list. Now, Phil Goff did not say on election night what he was doing about his leadership, although everybody knew he would resign. And he did wait until the caucus meeting, I think it was on Tuesday after the election, to announce his resignation, as did Annette King, the deputy leader. And they went into kind of what they called a primary process, where the contenders for the leadership went around and met with party leaders throughout the country. Now, my membership has lapsed, so I didn't know any of this. I knew it was going on, but I was never invited to any of the meetings, so I have not met these people. But there were originally three people who were running. All of them were named David, oddly enough. David Shearer, David Cunliffe, and David Parker. Now, David Parker dropped out pretty quickly, and that left David Cunliffe and David Shearer. Now, David Cunliffe, apparently a lot of people in the Labour caucus didn't like him. They thought he was arrogant. They thought he was too negative or whatever. And there was a debate in Christchurch for the Christchurch Press between John Key and Phil Goff. And John Key got a lot of mileage out of saying, "Show me the money." And the feeling in the party was that David Cunliffe left Phil Goff hanging out to dry by not giving him the numbers he needed to be able to counter that. And I don't know if that's true. That's just what's been reported in the media. I do know, though, that a lot of people didn't like him, including me. I thought he was I found him smarmy, but I also found him just phony and negative. David Shearer is from the more conservative wing of the party, and which concerns me, of course. But he has a history working in international aid agencies. He's worked in Mogadishu. He's worked in Afghanistan. He's worked in the Balkans somewhere in the former Yugoslavia. I don't remember where. Anyway, he's had a distinguished career doing that. And so as it became clear that he was the front runner to become the new Labour Party leader, people were starting to say things like, While John Key was making $50 million, David Scheer was saving 50 million lives. And there's an element of truth in that. Whether or not that plays out for the next 3 years or not, I don't know. Now, he's named as his deputy Grant Robertson, who's the Labour MP for Wellington Central, and he's also openly gay. And he is the first, as you might imagine, first openly gay deputy leader of any major party. And he is widely tipped by the right and the left alike as being potentially New Zealand's first openly gay prime minister. And I certainly could see that happen. He is highly regarded by people on both sides of the aisle as being smart, capable, a deep thinker, somebody who doesn't just take positions, but they give some thought to their positions, that sort of thing. And among the other people who were promoted were Jacinda Ardern, who lost Auckland Central, unfortunately, but she is a rising star in the party, and she actually could be prime minister one day as well, but she certainly has a bright future in the party. And so she picked up several portfolios and is now on the front bench. David Cunliffe went down one in his ranking, and he lost the finance spokesmanship, but he's taking on economic development, which is actually kind of a meaty portfolio. And David Parker is taking over finance, and I actually think that's probably a good role for him. Some of the other people who were winners in this were this guy named Clayton Cosgrove, who they considered to be a bit of a pit bull. And he is one of the three serving MP Labour Party MPs who voted against the civil unions bill, so I've a grudge against him. And another one who did is Ross Robertson, who is now he was going to be put forward for assistant speaker. I didn't hear if that actually went through or not. Lockwood Smith was reelected speaker today, but I don't know what happened to this Ross Robertson. The third one is this guy named Damien O'Connor, who did win the West Coast electorate back from National. But he's kind of on the outers of the party anyway, so it doesn't really matter. He doesn't have any positions, and he's not going to. He's just going to be another backbench MP. But among the National Party side, there's this guy from the Whanganui electorate named Chester Burrows who was elected. He was expecting to have a senior cabinet role. Well, he didn't get a senior one, but he did get one. And that's disappointing because not only was he one of the all of the National Party MPs who have been in Parliament, who were in Parliament in 2005, voted against the civil unions bill. That's a given. But he was outspokenly opposed to it. And so it's disappointing that they would give somebody like that a cabinet position of any sort. But they did. But among the new MPs is former Garden Show host Maggie Berry, who is the new National Party MP for North Shore. She replaced Wayne Mapp, who stood down at the last election, retired. And it is probably the truest, bluest National Party electorate, if not in all of New Zealand, then certainly in all of Auckland. You could run a cardboard cutout as the National Party candidate, and it would win. It's that blue, that electorate. And so she had no trouble. Now, she's not typical of your National Party members or MPs. She is more progressive in that sense. She may be blue in some ways, but she's green in others, not just because she was a Garden Show host, although that actually is relevant to environmental stuff, believe it or not. She's also been, in the past, she's been pro-gay. So that's a good thing as well, because Wayne Mapp he was a doofus, but he was not known for being socially aware, shall we say. Among the other people who have come in other parties, Andrew Little, who used to be president of the Labour Party, and before that was head of the Electrical Printing and Manufacturers Union, EPMU, is a new Labour List MP. He's going to be the ACC spokesperson. ACC is our workman's comp insurance, basically. And that may be a good choice. I don't know. I don't know how he's going to be in the House. For New Zealand First, I talked about some of the weirdos they brought in, but one of them they brought in was this guy named Brendan Horan, who used to be the weekend weatherman on TVNZ. So that's kind of odd. And I also said that the Greens were bringing in Mojo Mathers, who is the world's New Zealand's first profoundly deaf MP, and one of, I think, only four or five in the world, which is actually quite a big deal. But among the other people that the Greens are bringing in is a woman named Jan Logie, I don't know how you pronounce her name, who is the third openly lesbian person elected as an MP. So that's always a good thing in my book. And she's also highly regarded for I've forgotten what her area of expertise is off the top of my head because I've been, you know, trying to get all this information in my head to talk about it today. But whatever her field is, she's highly regarded. Take my word for it. But another of their MPs, of the Green Party MPs, their party list was filled with a lot of really good people this year. I mean, I didn't vote for them, but I, you know, hats off to them. They really gave some work to it, and they came up with some really interesting people. One of them is a woman named Holly Walker, who is a daughter of a solo mother. And she lived in a council flat, which is, you know, like state housing. But she went on to get a Rhodes Scholarship from Oxford University. So she's certainly no dummy. But one of my favorites is a woman named Eugenie Sage, who is a member of Environment Canterbury. Environment Canterbury is the regional council for Canterbury, includes Christchurch and Banks Peninsula and areas like that. I've forgotten what year it was, 2008 or 2010, I think it was. Yeah, I think it must have been 2010 or something. Anyway, the National Party sacked the entire elected body of Environment Canterbury, and they said they were dysfunctional, so they just sacked them. You're fired. You're out of here. And the reason they did it, that's what they said. They said they were dysfunctional. The real reason they did it was because the farmers of Canterbury wanted to have more water allocation because it's kind of like rationed, but it's, you know, the water that goes from dams, how much goes to agriculture, how much goes for power, how much goes for drinking, whatever, how much is allowed to go down the river. And Environment Canterbury was sticking on the side of the environment, which is what their job was. Farmers were very unhappy about this because they wanted more water for agriculture and especially dairy farming, which needs a lot of water. And so because the National Party relies on farmers to stay in power, they did what the farmers wanted, and they sacked the entire elected board and put in statutory managers. And so she was one of the people who was sacked. And so it will be interesting to see her taking on the National Party in Parliament. Hopefully she does. So there's been a lot of real interesting things with these I don't know, comings and goings of people. And I will have links to some of this various stuff in the show notes. I'm going to put a link to that thing about the polls again. No, I'm not. You can look in a previous episode for that. But I am going to put in a link to the actual official final results in the show notes. Now, the other big election of the day, of course, was the referendum. Now, the referendum was a very big deal indeed. As you know, that was the... It was probably the thing I cared about the most because I knew it was going to be the only thing where my vote actually might count for something or where I might win. Now, the percentage of the valid votes, the people voting to keep MMP was 57.77%, which is a resounding victory. And by anybody's imagining, as a matter of fact, I read, although I haven't had a chance to verify this, I read that it was actually higher than the percentage that MMP got when it was adopted in the first place. So hopefully this will be the last time the radical right will ever try to take it away from us, because this is a resounding victory for MMP. There is no two ways about it. Now, in that election, there were about 3% ultimately that were what we call informal, which means that maybe the voter didn't clearly indicate what they wanted, or maybe they didn't vote at all in it or something like that. I mean, Elections New Zealand says that it means that the voter hasn't clearly indicated what they want. But it could mean because I left it blank. It could be because instead of putting a check mark or a tick, as we call it, they put an X, or maybe they put one line, or maybe they put a circle, you know, whatever. But in some way, they didn't vote correctly. So there's about 3% of the keep change people, which is part A of the referendum, cast informal votes. Or as we used to say in Cook County in Illinois, they spoiled the ballot. In part B, it gets interesting. 31.19% of the, let me back up. The thing that's gotten the huge amount of news is that 46.66% of the people voted who were voting for change would pick first past the post. And a lot of people were wringing their hands about that. The important thing to remember is that first there was this, movement is too strong a word, but the suggestion from people on the left, center left, but left in particular, that people should vote to keep MMP and then vote for first past the post in the second part on the theory that it would be the easiest alternative to beat in a match off. Now, I didn't agree with that personally. I thought that was a really risky proposition to take, and so I voted for single transferable vote for the second vote. which was ended up being the third highest vote getter. The second was supplementary member at 24.14, which is what the prime minister said he wanted, because it's supplementary member is nothing more than first past the post in drag. And preferential voting, which is also called instant runoff voting in the U.S., very often it's called that, came in last, 12.47%. But that's how that's the banner headline that you hear. And like I said, the first thing to keep in mind is that a lot of the people voting for first past the post were doing so only because they thought it'd be the easiest one to beat in a runoff, as well as the fact that it's the only one of the four that people had probably heard of before, to be honest. I mean, anyway. However, remember the informal votes. 3% of the Part A votes were informal. 33.14%, more than a third of all the votes cast in Part B were informal. And when you add them into the equation, what that means is that that was the single highest result in Part B. More than a third of the people voting in Part B in some way or other invalidated their ballot, either because they weren't clear or because they deliberately didn't vote, which is apparently the most common thing from what I've heard. And the second highest then was first past the post at 31.19%. And this is a really significant thing because it means that people were very happy with MMP, and they weren't, even those who were dissatisfied, weren't dissatisfied enough to vote for first past the post. And, you know, that's a really significant thing because even, because when you take informal votes into account, like I said, you've got 31.19% in favor of first past the post, but you had 41.6% who were in favor of change. So they obviously dropped off. They wanted change, but they didn't want any of the alternatives, is what that amounts to. So that's a fascinating result. And I think that it shows very clearly that the people of New Zealand are more than happy with MMP, with keeping MMP. But of course, the other part of this is that it would set off the, what do you call it, the review process, I guess. And that's going to start in February. The Electoral Commission will call for submissions, and then they're going to be holding public hearings in April and May. And then around August, they're going to put forward a proposal paper for more public comment, and then they're going to give their final report to the Minister of Justice, who is now Judith Collins, in October. And whether or not Parliament does anything about the recommendations or not are a whole other matter. They could ignore them completely. But it's widely expected that the two things that they're going to look at most intently are the threshold, because right now you have to win one electorate seat or 5% of the vote in order to get a seat in Parliament. And they're going to look at whether or not that's fair, if it should be dropped or eliminated, or if it should be, I mean, reduced or eliminated. Or maybe it shouldn't be that if you get one electorate seat, then suddenly all of your vote, all of your party votes count. So they're going to look at that. And they're also going to look at the question, no doubt, of whether or not somebody can be both an electorate candidate and a list candidate. A lot of people, especially on the right, well, the right hates MMP anyway, but they're really incensed about that. They say that they reject somebody and they sneak back in on the party list, which is not the way it works. Very often people cast strategic votes and they think, right, in this electorate, I've got party from this, the candidate from, say, the Labour Party is really highly ranked. They're going to get back into Parliament regardless. But the National Party candidate's also pretty good. So if I vote for them, I might be able to get them in and I'll have two MPs. People aren't stupid. They can see these sort of things and they can do that. So I'm a bit dubious about that. And I'll talk about that later, especially once the discussion documents are released in February or thereabouts. And I'm almost certainly going to do a submission myself on this because I feel so strongly about it and about getting it right. So the bottom line is that the election results weren't really a surprise. Labour did slightly better than expected. National did slightly worse. The Greens and New Zealand First both did spectacularly better than had originally been expected. The government is again a coalition government, as MMP is meant, well, I don't know if it's meant to, but as MMP almost always creates. And so that's all very good. I wish that Labour was leading the government, but that was not to be. And now we'll see if the new Labour leader, David Shearer, can put the party back on track toward victory in 2014. He reckons that he's got a year and a half to 2 years to turn around the fortunes of the Labour Party, or he'll be turfed out. Well, I don't know. We'll see. Yeah, there's a lot of things that could happen between now and then. And, of course, the best news was that MMP was overwhelmingly kept, overwhelmingly chosen by the voters. The worst thing in the whole night was that over a million New Zealanders didn't even bother to vote. And that's always disgusting. We have voluntary voting in New Zealand. We have mandatory registration, but voluntary voting. And I think it should remain that, by the way. But it is disgusting that a million people, about a quarter of the population, couldn't even be bothered to vote. The most precious and most important thing that they have available to them as free people, and they couldn't even be bothered to vote. I mean, remember the people with their ink-stained fingers after the first free elections in Iraq. And the people who had those stained fingers who were risked being shot by sectarians because they had dared to express their democratic rights. Remember the people queuing in South Africa for days and standing in queues that were kilometers long to get the right to vote in the first free elections after the fall of apartheid in South Africa. And you got these people here in a Western, supposedly civilized country, and they can't even be bothered to vote. I am rather disgusted by that. I will be honest about it. Now, on to other things. I do have some voice messages that I'm going to get to. But first, the thing that delayed me this time was that I have, as you may recall, I have two work projects in December. I have an annual one and my normal monthly one. Well, the normal monthly one was also much bigger than usual. The paper was about 40% bigger than a normal one because it was their 20th anniversary or whatever. Well, it was, not whatever. It wasn't 20th anniversary. And so I needed all of the time I had available to me, and then some, in order to be able to make deadline. Now, I have struggled a lot this year with being able to stay on target. And it's got nothing, well, sometimes it has had to do with others, things beyond my control. But by and large, it's all been about me. I don't want to get all Calvinist and all that, but basically that there's some failings that I need to address, and I'm going to be doing that in the coming year. But because of that, I basically did a number on myself. I made things far worse than it needed to be, and that is why ultimately I couldn't podcast or blog really or do anything, and why I've been off of social media for basically 3 weeks or so. My final project finished on Thursday of last week, and it should have been finished at the latest by Monday of that week. And the project before that finished on Sunday night, and it should have finished probably Friday at the latest, the Friday before that. And so, you know, a lot of things I did wrong, and I'm going to have to address that in the coming year. And if there's anything to talk about, I'll talk about that later. But at this point, there really isn't. Just that I've got to resolve to be better. That's not a New Year's resolution, by the way, because I don't believe in New Year's resolutions. I believe you set yourself up to fail. Anyway, so that is what was going on. Two huge projects. I was way behind time due to my own fault, and I just didn't have time to podcast or to blog or anything. But that's all behind me now, and now I'm just getting the house ready for Christmas, which is a big job, but it's a lot more fun, I can tell you. So that is that. Now let's go shift gears to the voicemails. And the first one is from Scott, a.k.a. Seder69.
Hey, Arthur, this is Scott, a.k.a. Seder69 of the Seder Sphere podcast. I just wanted to call because I'm listening to your latest show. And first of all, Bink, if you're listening, you have the cutest damn voice I've ever heard in my life. I think you are adorable. But I'm going to continue the holiday talk. You mentioned how so many traditions are started by holidays in the Northern Hemisphere, and how stores down in New Zealand have like snow and reindeer for Christmas, even though it's a summer holiday for you. And I liked what Bink was saying about how Easter to her was a last hurrah before summer ended. I'm like, I can totally dig that. I can see that. But my question is, and I don't want to sound like this is a Western Hemisphere, or I'm sorry, a Northern Hemisphere bias, but what holidays has the Southern Hemisphere created, is that the right word, and are now part of more of a Northern Hemisphere mentality? Or in the case of Halloween, which really seems to be a very American holiday, although it's based in Celtic traditions, that it's not taking over in New Zealand. Can you think of any holidays that New Zealand has that, or any other country that other countries have adopted? The closest I can think of is Boxing Day, which, granted, the majority of Americans don't really know what Boxing Day is, but for those of us who do, you know, I honor Boxing Day and go do community work that day. But I don't think it's taken a big hold in America. But can you think of any other holidays that a southern hemisphere or another country have, is primarily their country, their holiday that America follows? I'm just curious, because you are the smartest man I know, and you know everything. I think I rambled on too much on that one. Okay, so this is Scott. I love your show. Thanks for everything. We'll chat you later. Bye-bye.
Well, thanks, Scott. Scott is from the Sadish Sphere podcast, and a little side here about that. It is it's one of the most interestingly structured podcasts of any that I've ever heard, because, I mean, some podcasts, as you know, are far more structured and some are far more loose, like this one, which doesn't have segments and that sort of thing. But his is in the context of a flight. And I just find that fascinating. Then he does these other ones called in-flight, mid-flight entertainment. Is it in-flight or mid-flight? I'd have to look it up. I don't remember. I'm like that. I'm old. But it's really quite fun. Some people may find some parts of the Satosphere challenging, shall we say. Scott will know what I mean. The Tales of the Impaler in particular. But it is a lot of fun, and so is Scott. I've had a lot to do with him through the, especially through Pride 48 Family and so on. But he's really good value, as we say. And I'll put a link specifically in the show notes, but you can find his show in my links. Now, Scott, as to your question, no. Short answer, no. Boxing Day emanates from Britain, of course, and was spread throughout the Commonwealth, well, back during the days of the British Empire, no doubt. In New Zealand, I have to tell you, Boxing Day is nothing more than a public holiday. It's a day off work for most people, and it's a day to go hit the stores for the after Christmas sales, or the Boxing Day sales, which is usually more than a day. It's usually an entire week. And that's all it is here. People, there is no tradition that I'm aware of doing public service or donating anything on Boxing Day. It's a day off. And that's it is just a day off. And that's really all there is to it. Certainly are no holidays that have come from New Zealand or Australia and gone around the world. And part of that is because the majority of the population is in the Northern Hemisphere. It kind of figures. But Boxing Day is probably one of the few that has spread around the world. Now, I talked before about Guy Fawkes Day, which has taken on a life of its own outside of England. But it's actually not about Guy Fawkes so much. It's about the movie V for Vendetta. The mask that you see in Occupy protests and so on is taken from the movie V for Vendetta. It has nothing to do with Guy Fawkes Day. And I would wager that the vast majority of people who even adopt that mask as a symbol, that Guy Fawkes mask or whatever, have no idea what the real story of Guy Fawkes is or the Gunpowder Plot or any of that stuff. That would be my guess. So that's... kind of spread, but it's changed so much. I suppose it's a bit like Christmas has changed over the centuries. It's very little to do with the original stories. Halloween obviously is another one. Easter is another one, because Easter was about fertility and all that sort of stuff. The only thing, and I'm sure I mentioned this when I was talking about holidays, the only thing that is in New Zealand and it's not going to be going around the world is Matariki, which is it's the Maori New Year, and it celebrates the rise of the Matariki constellation, which is also known as the Pleiades or the Seven Sisters. When that rises, that was an indication of Maori that the planting season was coming soon, and so there's a celebration of that. And that's actually taking off more and more in New Zealand. People are beginning to have parties around that time, and there are increasing number of festivals around Matariki, especially arts and culture festivals, not just Māori either, but general ones. So what I'm getting at is it's becoming more of a general holiday and not something that's specific to Māori alone, as Waitangi Day has two different aspects of it. That's our national holiday, of course. There's the part dealing with the Treaty of Waitangi, which is increasingly Māori-focused, And then there is what everybody else does, which is just have a day off work and they have a barbecue or go to the beach or whatever. Two distinct days on the same date. That's not true so much. Well, it is actually, it's similar, I suppose, with Matariki in that both communities do observe it, but there's a lot of overlap and there's certainly no cultural baggage that goes along with that as there is with Waitangi Day. But no, is the answer, Scott. I can't think of a single holiday that has come from the Southern Hemisphere, any country in the Southern Hemisphere, and made its way north. And many of the ones in the South are of Northern Hemisphere origin because that's where they were invented. But I also think that Benk was absolutely right that you perceive them as they were when you were growing up. And so people of European descent have been living in the Southern Hemisphere for a couple centuries, more than a couple centuries now, several centuries. And so they have obviously become used to the Southern Hemisphere seasons and seasonal cycles and those sorts of things. So it's natural for them to think that, of course, Christmas is going to be a summer holiday. And, of course, Easter is going to be an autumn, early winter holiday and those sorts of things. And it's all about what you grew up with. And I said a long, long time ago that the idea of a warm Christmas wouldn't have been that bizarre to me if I had come from a warm place, like, say, Southern Florida or Hawaii or somewhere like that. It would not have been anywhere near as bizarre to me as it was since I came from the cold, frozen shores of Lake Michigan. So, yeah, I hope that answers your question, Scott. I think I did, because the short answer is no. But thanks for the call, and I look forward to talking with you in real life soon. It's been a while. I think the last time we were on a show together was when I was doing This Week in Gay, when it first started. So I don't think we've been on a show together since then that I can recall anyway. And I have one more phone message. I'm just trying to decide. Yeah, I'll do that now. And it is from Roger Green.
Hello, Arthur. Happy Xmas. Bye.
Well, thanks for that, Roger. And Merry Xmas to you, too. That's actually my Xmas gift because you've extended my phone line well into January now. So thanks for that. What Roger's sort of obliquely referring to is we've had this ongoing discussion about Xmas and whether or not it's good or bad or whatever. My parents hated it. My mother used to say that X is the unknown quantity. I was always a bit more about it. I didn't really care that much. But my objection to it was based purely on aesthetics because, I mean, professionally, I deal with typography and text layout and so on. And to me, Xmas just looks inelegant. It has nothing to do with the word or the meaning or what have you. It actually is not altogether inappropriate, however, because the X translates as the first letter of the name Christ in Greek. So it's actually not the weird anti-Christian thing that some culture warriors in the U.S. like to make it out to be. And I actually posted on my blog, I'll put a link in the show notes, I posted a video from the Thinking Atheist who talks about a lot of the Christmas traditions and how many of them are misunderstood by Christians, including Xmas versus Christmas. So anyway, but thanks for that, everyone. Thanks for the phone calls. One last thing before I go. This is sort of news. I normally do news at the start of the podcast, but of course I was talking about the election this time. And this isn't timely so much anymore because this originally came out about a week or so ago. But there was a story about the cloud on Queen's Wharf. Now, you might remember that they, as part of the Rugby World Cup, they put up this big white structure thing they called the cloud. It kind of looks like a bug, a caterpillar or something. And it was sort of a visitor center of sorts on Queen's Wharf during the Rugby World Cup. And they had, it was run by New Zealand Trade and Enterprise, and it was meant to showcase technology and innovation and so on here in New Zealand in various sectors. There was wine and I think something about merino wool, I think, even, and all kinds of different stuff. And engines, all sorts of stuff. But they did polling of people who were visiting it, and they found that it increased people's positive perceptions of New Zealand, increased the positive perception of New Zealand related to innovation by 72%, technology by 66%, and that was technologically advanced by 59%. And I found that fascinating that one little display essentially could do that. It does tend to show that people from other countries are reasonably poorly educated about the reality of New Zealand. But basically, This is the percentage, the perceptions of New Zealand as technologically advanced before and after visit to the cloud. Americans, 43% perceived of New Zealand as technologically advanced before the visit, 59% after the visit. Asians, it was 18% before, 36% after. Australians, 34% before, and 58% after. Europeans, of general sorts, 35% before, 55% after. And South Africans, 50% before, and 75% after. So I think no matter how you look at it, the cloud was a huge success. And it would be nice if there were more opportunities to do that. But, you know, kudos to New Zealand Trade and Enterprise for figuring out a way to leverage off the Rugby World Cup and get some positive attention for New Zealand and the reality of New Zealand. Now, as I said, I am going to be doing the Moving to New Zealand Revisited episode soon in early January. So if there is anything you'd like to know about moving to New Zealand, do let me know. You can leave a comment on this episode or you can send an email to me. All of that information is at the very end of this episode and I will try to work that in. But do get a move on because I'm probably going to do my research and stuff over the Christmas break because there will be times when I just won't have much to do and I might as well do that. Hey, I may or may not have another podcast this week. If I don't, I won't be back, and I don't expect to be back until January, but you never know. Something might pop up in the feed all of a sudden. But if I don't talk to you beforehand, have a great Christmas and New Year, and I will talk to you sooner than last time. Bye.
You can leave a comment on this or any other episode of the Amrens Podcast at amrenspodcast.com. You can send an email to me at Arthur, that's A-R-T-H-U-R, at amrenspodcast.com, or you can ring my U.S. comment line on 206-666-5172. This podcast is produced and distributed on a Creative Commons license. Complete details at the website.